Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Tuesday, June 23rd, 2026, and this is our Commodities and Energy Edition.
Today, we are examining the resurgence of structural fragility in global supply chains. We are moving away from a period of assumed logistical fluidity toward a landscape defined by localized bottlenecks and heightened geopolitical friction.
Essentially, the era of frictionless global trade is officially over.
The implication runs deeper. That fragility is most acute right now at our primary energy choke points.
We begin by analyzing the escalating supply risks surrounding the Strait of Hormuz. June 18th, a meeting at the Palace of Versailles, and a signed memorandum of understanding that has everyone from Wall Street to the Kremlin holding their breath. We're looking at the new US-Iran deal and what it actually means for the flow of oil and gas through the Strait of Hormuz.
It's a massive moment for commodity markets, Maya, but the mechanics are incredibly complex. We aren't looking at a permanent peace treaty. We're looking at a pay-for-performance model, as Dave McCormick has noted, where sanctions relief is strictly contingent on verifiable milestones, specifically regarding the removal of enriched uranium and ensuring the unhindered passage through the strait.
Pay-for-performance. That sounds less like diplomacy and more like a corporate bonus structure. Are we just paying Iran to behave?
In a sense, yes. There's a significant argument that this MOU is essentially a massive economic transfer. We're talking about access to frozen assets and even a potential $300 billion reconstruction fund. The idea is to stabilize the global energy market by providing enough economic incentive to prevent a total blockade of the strait.
But if the incentive is just don't block the tankers, hasn't the leverage already shifted? It feels like the US is essentially paying a subscription fee to keep the lights on in Europe.
That's exactly what some analysts are seeing. There's this idea emerging of a new politics of accommodation. Instead of a total blockade, we might see Iran institutionalizing its leverage by transitioning from kinetic warfare to an administrative model. As the Columbia Energy Exchange pointed out, Iran could effectively monetize its control by charging service fees or environmental fees per ship. We could be looking at the Strait of Hormuz becoming a permanent, lifetime toll booth.
So instead of naval mines, we just get a very expensive invoice every time a VLCC enters Iranian waters.
Something to flag here, the technology makes that much easier to execute now. The Columbia Energy Exchange also highlighted that the use of inexpensive, attributable drone technology has fundamentally altered maritime blockade strategies. Iran doesn't need a massive fleet of minesweepers. They can use drones to disrupt or threaten traffic without the logistical burden of traditional naval defenses, making it much harder for the U.S. Navy to provide a guarantee of safety.
Which brings us to the peace part of this deal. If they can still disrupt the lanes with a few hobbyist drones, is anyone actually safer?
It's a tenuous truce. On Bloomberg Surveillance, experts discussed how Iran is essentially using a double-edged sword strategy, linking the stability of the Lebanese front and the fate of Hezbollah directly to the status of the strait. If the ceasefire fails in Lebanon, the justification for closing the maritime choke point is immediately on the table.
And yet, despite all this edge, oil prices aren't exactly hitting $200 a barrel. If the threat is so real, why is Brent trading closer to $73?
Because the physical reality of the supply chain has changed. There was massive fear of a 15 million barrel per day supply shock, but the impact has been mitigated by a massive structural rebalancing. Superspike noted that the crisis didn't require a return to pre-crisis production levels to stabilize, because Saudi Arabia and the UAE have already redirected enough volume via pipelines and incremental flows to permanently reduce the required strait utilization rate to about 55 to 60% of its former capacity.
So the choke point is less of a bottleneck if you just build enough bypass pipes.
And it's not just the Middle East. The Americas are filling the gap. We're seeing increased exports from Brazil, Guyana, and Venezuela. Even China played a role in the recent price stabilization. Superspike found that China's significant reduction in oil imports, estimated between 4.5 and 6 million barrels per day during the crisis, acted as a primary, though perhaps underanalyzed, mechanism for suppressing those $150 to $200 price scenarios.
So the world's biggest buyer just stopped buying, which kept the prices from exploding. That's not a solution, that's just a temporary reprieve.
It's a reprieve that's masking some very real vulnerabilities. The U.S. is in a precarious position because our strategic petroleum reserve has declined to levels we haven't seen since the Reagan administration. We're essentially using depleted reserves to mask the upward pressure on prices. And while the U.S. is a major LNG exporter now, which helps Europe, we're also seeing a shift in how the tankers move. The HC Commodities podcast noted that Middle Eastern suppliers are mitigating risk by shifting the burden of transport to the buyers. For instance, the UAE is using smaller ships to shuttle crude to offshore Oman before performing ship-to-ship transfers to buyer-operated vessels.
It's getting incredibly convoluted. We're moving from simple shipping lanes to a complex game of maritime shell games and shuttle tankers.
And that complexity comes with new, non-obvious risks. It's not just about oil. Persistent disruptions in the strait could threaten the supply of helium, which is absolutely critical for semiconductor manufacturing. If the gas stops flowing, the entire high-tech supply chain hits a wall.
And we can't ignore the recent accident in Qatar. If the infrastructure itself starts failing, all these bypass pipelines and shuttle tankers won't matter.
You're right. Argus Media pointed out that the stability of the regional energy market faces a new systemic risk because the rapid production ramps promised by Kuwait and others may trigger industrial accidents, much like the recent massive gas explosion at Qatar's Ras Laffan complex.
So we have an agreement that might be a bad deal trap for the Trump administration, a maritime landscape that's becoming a toll road, and a supply chain that's one explosion away from a total breakdown.
It's a period of extreme strategic uncertainty. Even the proponents of the deal, like Dave McCormick, are framing it as pay for performance. The moment the performance stops, the moment the uranium isn't removed or the drones start hitting tankers again, the whole structure could collapse.
It sounds like the piece we're seeing is just a very expensive way of delaying the inevitable.
Or at least, a very expensive way of buying time for the global market to build more redundancy.
Investors in Gulf-dependent energy cargoes need to prepare for significantly higher operational costs as service fees become a permanent line item. Keep a close eye on the volume of heavy tankers entering Omani waters, because any shift back toward Iranian-controlled lanes will be the first sign that the pay-for-performance model has failed. But as the energy markets try to find their footing, a new kind of instability is creeping into the heart of the financial system, one where the old rules of transparency and predictability are being rewritten by a new era of central bank volatility. I thought I was reading a satire piece about a minimalist poet, but it turns out this is just the new Federal Reserve. The FOMC statement has been slashed from 341 words in April to just 131.
It's not poetry, Maya, it's a deliberate pivot toward extreme brevity. Chair Kevin Warsh is attempting to move the Fed away from being a price maker through overexplanation and toward a data-reactive model where the central bank simply reacts to incoming economic indicators.
So instead of a roadmap, we've been given a post-it note. This whole new Fed regime under Warsh feels like a massive retreat into the shadows.
It's more of a structural retreat. Unhedged noted that this represents a fundamental shift from aspirational communication to deterministic policy. Under Powell, the Fed was trying to guide us toward a desired outcome. Warsh is essentially making a unilateral vow to achieve price stability without the how-to guide.
Which is particularly fun for anyone trying to trade commodities. If the Fed isn't telling us where they're going, we're essentially playing a game of blind man's buff with interest rates.
And the tools for playing that game are disappearing. We're seeing the potential removal of the dot plot and the summary of economic projections entirely. Even in the recent meeting, the dot plot was reduced from 19 to 18 dots.
Wait, you're telling me he literally deleted himself from the forecast?
That's exactly what happened. Unhedged called it the dot burglar tactic. By intentionally omitting his own economic projection from the dot plot, Warsh is using a structural mechanism to enforce a regime of reduced forward guidance. He's intentionally creating a communication vacuum to prevent the market from trying to front-run his next move.
It sounds incredibly efficient for the Fed, but it's a nightmare for volatility. If you can't see the dots, you start guessing, and guessing leads to spikes.
Worth noting, Claudia Sahm argued on Bloomberg Surveillance that this lack of transparency creates a gap that markets will inevitably fill with volatility. We already saw it, a 13 basis point rise in the two-year yield to 4.18% following the news. When the Fed stops providing the anchors, the market starts looking for new ones, often in the most volatile places.
And let's not forget that for the energy and metals sectors, volatility isn't just a number on a screen, it's a massive shift in the cost of capital and the cost of hedging.
And the way Warsh is doing this is almost deceptive. Ed Yardeni, speaking on Bloomberg Surveillance, characterized him as a hawk in dove's clothing. He's using a persona that suggests alignment with the Trump administration's preference for rate cuts, but his actual policy is shifting toward a tightening bias. None of the 18 FOMC members are already signaling that hikes might be necessary later this year.
It's a clever way to keep the inflation-fighting side of the house quiet while the markets try to price in a pivot. But there's a massive elephant in the room, the U.S. deficit. You can't talk about price stability without talking about how the Fed is going to manage a multi-trillion dollar balance sheet while the Treasury keeps spending.
That is the core tension. We are entering a regime of fiscal dominance, as Bloomberg Surveillance suggested. The Fed is facing a trilemma, managing the massive fiscal deficit, maintaining a shrinking balance sheet, and ensuring market stability. If you try to solve any two, you likely destabilize the third.
It feels like the Fed is trying to act like the ECB, just hiding the family fights by not disclosing individual member voting results for the first time. It's very united front, very much don't look at the cracks in the foundation.
It's a move toward institutional opacity. But the real danger for commodity producers and global investors is what happens to the dollar. MacroVoices pointed out that a dual carry trade creates a structural disadvantage for non-US nations. They have to manage both local and global dollar-denominated spreads. If Warsh's opacity leads to a sudden, unexpected spike in dollar strength outside of a predictable band, it triggers sovereign funding crises in a huge portion of emerging markets.
The Fed stops being a guide and starts being a black box. And if that black box suddenly sneezes, the entire commodity exporting world catches a cold.
And the mechanism for that sneeze is the inflation target itself. There is talk, as Anna Wong suggested on Macro Matters, about moving away from precise numerical targets toward band-based reporting to account for measurement errors. Instead of saying we want 2%, they might just say we want it in this range.
Which is just another way of saying we'll tell you when we feel like it. It's a massive shift in accountability.
It is.
But there's an argument to be made that the Fed's previous official mothering of the markets was actually damaging. Macro Musings with David Beckworth argued that this intervention erodes market resilience by discouraging dealers from maintaining the necessary capital and balance sheet capacity. By moving toward a neutral bystander role, allowing market-driven yield spikes to serve as a disciplinary mechanism, the Fed might actually be forcing the market to price the reality of U.S. fiscal policy.
Or as David Beckert put it, they're just pathologizing rational market reactions. If the market reacts to a spike in long-term yields by screaming fiscal insolvency, and the Fed treats that as market dysfunction rather than a signal, they aren't solving the problem. They're just ignoring the smoke while the house burns.
And the ratchet effect makes it much harder to fix later. As Beckworth noted, balance sheet reductions are structurally more difficult than expansions because banks and dealers have already re-engineered their entire reserve management systems to accommodate the old liquidity levels. You can't just pull the plug without breaking the plumbing.
We have a Fed chair who is intentionally erasing his own footprints, a committee that is hiding its internal disagreements, and a policy framework that is moving away from targets and toward vague ranges.
It's a move toward a price stability monoculture. Warsh mentioned inflation 19 times in his recent communications, while the labor market was only mentioned 4 times. The priority is clear: anchor the inflation expectation at any cost, even if it means letting the volatility run wild in the bond markets.
Energy traders need to watch the Fed's use of specialized task forces to see if they start manipulating reserve ratios to control the money supply.
Keep an eye on the 2-year Treasury yield. Any move that breaks out of the recent 4.18% level could signal that the market is no longer accepting the Fed's new opaque band approach.
But if the central bank is stepping back from its role as a market insurer, it leaves a massive vacuum for the next big resource war, specifically the desperate race for the metals needed to power the AI revolution. I'm starting to think the intelligence in artificial intelligence is actually just a very expensive way to burn through the Earth's crust. We keep talking about software and models, but if you look at the physical reality, we aren't building a digital brain. We're building a massive heat-generating furnace that eats copper and electricity.
It's definitely a shift from idea-heavy, capital-light to capital-heavy, but calling it a furnace might be a stretch. We are seeing a fundamental transition in the investment cycle. The chatbot era of conversational commerce is giving way to agentic AI and workflow automation, which is driving a secondary, much more intense wave of data center infrastructure demand because the token consumption per task is skyrocketing.
Okay, so we've gone from asking a computer to write a poem to asking it to run an entire supply chain. Fine, but that secondary wave sounds like a polite way of saying we're about to run out of plugs.
That's actually the central bottleneck. According to Sightline Climate, the primary constraint on the AI revolution isn't a lack of venture capital, but a lack of power. There is a massive disparity right now between announced data center real estate and actual deliverable capacity. In fact, they estimate about 50% of announced U.S. data center capacity is likely to fail to materialize because the underlying power projects, permits, and equipment contracts simply aren't there.
Half of these billion-dollar campuses are just expensive, empty warehouses waiting for a transformer that might never arrive. That is a spectacular way to burn investor capital.
It's why the energy strategy is changing. We're moving away from Clean Tech 1, which was just about deploying renewables, toward a focus on managing massive load growth and security. At the Euroelectric Power Summit, Lawrence Segalin and Catherine McGregor noted that the expansion of these energy-intensive sectors is forcing a move from simple power purchase agreements toward custom solutions. Hyperscalers aren't just buying green electrons anymore. They are demanding integrated power landing, energy management, and on-site storage to accelerate their time to market.
It sounds like the big tech firms are basically trying to become their own private utility companies.
In many ways, they are. And that demand is hitting the commodities market with a vengeance. It's not just about the big stuff like copper or steel. We are entering a specialized metals race. Cyan Morris from Argus Media pointed out that gallium nitride is now critical for meeting data center energy demands, and indium phosphide is essential for high-speed, energy-efficient optical connectivity.
Wait, so we're now scrambling for obscure elements that most people can't even pronounce.
The data tells a story. Here is where the supply chain gets incredibly fragile. Argus Media highlighted a structural vulnerability. Materials like gallium and germanium are often produced as byproducts of other mining processes. This makes the supply inelastic. You can't just turn a knob and suddenly produce more gallium because demand spiked. You have to scale the entire primary mining operation that happens to yield it as a secondary product.
If a new AI model requires a sudden surge in germanium, we're just stuck waiting for someone to dig a new hole in the ground.
So here's the picture. The geopolitical layer adds even more volatility. We're seeing Chinese export controls on things like indium phosphide, and the conflict in the DRC is driving up tantalite prices. Christina Belder at Argus emphasized that these controls are creating massive uncertainty across the entire landscape of metals used in data center construction. The only way to bridge the gap, according to the analysts, is to focus on the secondary supply, increasing the recycling and recovery of germanium and gallium from scrap and waste streams.
It's a lovely thought, recycling our way to the next industrial revolution. But while we're looking for scrap, the sheer volume of power needed is becoming an ecological contradiction. I keep hearing about how AI will solve climate change, but the infrastructure itself looks like a carbon bomb.
That is the existential risk. Jeremy Grantham has argued that we are seeing a profound tension between AI's massive energy requirements and the global climate crisis. The Magnificent Seven are engaged in what he calls a blood-curdling arms race, pouring hundreds of billions into a single shared market that could actually destroy their own previous profit margins. The energy demands of autonomous humanoid robotics alone could dwarf current computing needs, potentially accelerating resource depletion.
And it's not just a global problem, it's a local one. I was looking at the markets in Virginia.
Right, the AI energy nexus is hitting Virginia particularly hard. Bella Krishna and Michael Ball from Argus Media noted that because Virginia accounts for roughly 35% of all known hyperscale data centers, it's a primary driver for increased emissions and much higher demand for carbon allowances in the RGGI market. The sheer scale of the footprint is essentially a persistent bullish driver for long-term emissions.
If you're an investor in carbon credits, you're basically betting on how many GPUs are plugged in Northern Virginia.
It's a massive shift. We're even seeing new players enter the fray. Siteline Climate noted that Anthropic's entry into the Frontier Coalition marks an era where pure AI firms are becoming direct carbon removal buyers, bypassing the traditional renewable energy procurement methods used by the older giants like Google.
It's a complete reconfiguration of the entire stack, from the minerals in the ground to the carbon credits in the air.
It is.
It's a transition from a world of software efficiency to a world of hardware constraints. We are seeing the limits of what can be achieved without a massive, physical, and incredibly expensive expansion of the energy and metals sectors.
Investors need to stop looking at the software margins and start looking at the transformer delivery schedules.
Keep a close eye on the next round of Chinese export restrictions on critical minerals, because any further tightening on the gallium or indium supply chain will immediately break the projected timelines for next-generation hardware.
But if the energy for all this is getting so expensive, it makes you wonder if the same pressure is going to start squeezing the margins on the basic fuels that keep the rest of the world moving. Everyone is acting like the European diesel market is on the brink of a total meltdown. But honestly, looking at the current inventories, isn't this just a lot of noise around a very manageable seasonal uptick?
It's more than noise, Maya. We're seeing a fundamental mismatch. While Russia remains a massive diesel exporter, Elza Turner highlighted that Ukrainian strikes on facilities like the Moscow refinery are injecting real volatility into the supply chain and stalling the very equipment upgrades needed to stabilize things.
So we have refinery outages, but we also have this massive transatlantic arbitrage opportunity everyone is obsessed with. Are we actually moving fuel or just moving paper?
We're moving molecules, but the math is getting interesting. Oil Markets reported a double incentive mechanism is strengthening the gasoline arbitrage from the ARA hub to the US, driven by price differentials rising about 75% over the last 3 months paired with a 40% drop in mid-range cargo freight rates.
Wait, so it's getting more expensive to buy the fuel but cheaper to ship it? That sounds like the universe is trying to balance itself out through pure chaos.
It's a textbook causal chain. But even if the price signals are screaming for more gasoline, refineries are stuck. Oil Markets noted they face a yield trap, where a limited 5% to 10% flexibility in processing capacity means they can't just flip a switch from diesel to gasoline.
I sometimes wonder if anyone actually understands these refineries, or if we're all just pretending to follow the jargon.
The supply side is even more constrained in Russia. According to Oil Markets, a lack of FCC units stalled by sanctions prevents them from matching their diesel surplus with gasoline production, creating a structural deficit.
Traders should watch the St. Petersburg Exchange for disappearing sellers as a proxy for these outages.
Keep an eye on whether U.S. refinery yield competition for jet fuel intensifies this summer.
But does this same volatility extend to the metals markets, or are we moving from nickel supply shifts to the economics of Brazilian crops?
We have to talk about the massive supply tightening hitting the nickel market, because Indonesia is essentially pulling the plug on its own surplus.
Pulling the plug is a bit dramatic, isn't it? I assume you mean they're just adjusting some spreadsheets in Jakarta.
Not just spreadsheets, Maya. Argus Media reports that Indonesia's nickel supply is facing a structural deficit in 2026, as the current RKB production quota has dropped to 270 million tons against an estimated 330 million ton demand.
A massive shortfall is baked into the math.
Stepping back, the localized shock is already hitting specific assets. Argus Media notes that the transition of Rudab Bay nickel into care and maintenance, following a quota drop from 42 million to just 12 million tons, could destabilize global availability for NPI and MHP.
And I suppose the Indonesian government is strategically incentivizing aluminum instead, which is just a polite way of saying they're pivoting to whatever has higher margins right now.
That's exactly what's happening. Producers are scaling back nickel-related smelting to prioritize aluminum. But the complexity doesn't end with metals, it's cascading into agriculture.
How does a nickel quota in Indonesia lead to a corn crisis in Brazil?
It's a chain of input costs and climate. We're seeing a food cascade risk for late 2026. In Brazil, the 26-27 season is facing a dual threat. Argus Media highlights that yields in Mato Grosso are under downward pressure because El Niño-driven dry spells are being compounded by reduced fertilizer application due to high input costs.
It's not just that the rain isn't falling, it's that the farmers can't afford the chemicals to fix the fallout.
Argus Media warns the primary risk to the 26-27 winter corn crop is a cascading temporal delay. El Niño delays the soybean planting, which forces the corn into a high-risk, uninsurable sowing window starting in March.
Investors in Brazilian soy futures need to reevaluate their risk premiums for the next planting cycle. Watch for any significant uptick in sulfur import costs, as that will be the first domino to trip the fertilizer supply chain. As we wrap up this edition, the common thread connecting everything from the US-Iran MOU to the shrinking Indonesian nickel quotas is a fundamental pivot from a world of predictable supply chains toward one defined by strategic bottlenecks. We are seeing a landscape where energy security and technological progress are no longer just about finding the cheapest source, but about securing the physical high-stakes corridors and raw materials that remain accessible.
That's right, Maya. The single most critical implication here is the shifting calculus for global commodity traders and sovereign wealth funds. The recent volatility in the Fed's communication, the shrinking statements and the reduced dot plot means they can no longer rely on central bank transparency to hedge against geopolitical shocks. Instead, they must now price in a new reality where energy-intensive industries, particularly those scaling AI infrastructure in places like Virginia, are essentially competing for a finite pool of power and minerals in an increasingly opaque market. The margin for error in navigating these localized vulnerabilities has evaporated.
It's a much more reactive environment. We're moving from managing cost to managing the risk of total physical unavailability.
If you want to know if this trend of localized, high-friction energy and metal markets is hardening into a permanent state, keep a close eye on the next round of Indonesian nickel export quotas. If we see a further contraction in the Rudab Bay production limits, it will confirm that the race for critical minerals is no longer just a supply challenge, but a structural barrier to the entire global energy transition and the expansion of the digital economy.
We'll be watching that closely. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday, June 23rd. We'll see you next week.